Welcome to the BISCOS Pediatric Orthopaedic Digest or podcast. It's a panel discussion of what we regard as the most interesting published papers of relevance to pediatric orthopaedic surgeons. Please do remember the views are our own and not those of the BISCOS board, committees or membership. We're making a sequel. Right, so guys, as they said in the second Muppet movie in recent times, here is the sequel. It's the BISCOS Pediatric Orthopaedic Digest cast. I'm Anish Singrajka, and as last time, we've got Alpesh Kothari, and we've got producer Pranay. And our special guest today is Steve Cook, Captain CPIPs. So I'm going to hand over to Alpesh.
Hi, Steve. Nice to see you again. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well, very well. Thanks for inviting me.
So you, like me, we missed BISCOS, unfortunately. It sounds like it had a great time.
Yeah, it's a real shame. I mean, it's, you know, you can't go to everyone, and I got to go to CP Club this year, and I'm going to ESMAC. So, yeah, it's a bit fair to let the other guys have a go.
Good stuff. So, Steve, you, a couple of years ago, you kindly gave some teaching for our registrars, and that still goes down as the most legendary teaching session ever. You got the best feedback that we've seen. You were like top marks across the board. So thanks again.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Another opportunity to thank you.
It's interesting when you get invited to do teaching for other people's registrars, you have to make more of an effort than sometimes for your own registrars, which is probably not the right way to do it.
But thanks again. So Steve, for people, I mean, everyone knows you really, but for people who maybe don't, could you tell us a bit about your unit, you know, where you work, your practice, and what's great about Coventry?
Sure. So I've been working in Coventry as a consultant since beginning of 2011, hot off the tails off the Sick Kids Fellowship in Toronto. In fact, all of us in Coventry have done the Sick Kids Fellowship. It wasn't on the job description, but it just seems to have worked out that way. There's four of us in Coventry. There's myself, Dan Westercott, Chris Hill, and Giles Patterson. And actually, one of the things I'm most proud of in Coventry is that Chris and Dan are both local trainees. They're people we've kind of enthused and inspired to do pediatrics along the way, and now both consultant colleagues. And certainly when those two started, that was the first thing that made me feel a bit old. Having trainees as consultant colleagues does certainly ages you, and I didn't feel like the new boy anymore. But yeah, it's a lovely unit to work in. We do almost exclusively pediatrics, so we have a separate pediatric on-call rota, so I don't have to do any adult trauma. My subspecial, since there were now four of us, we've been able to sort of subspecialize a little bit. So we all take a fair share of the general pediatric orthopedics, but myself and Chris Hill take all of the neuromuscular patients, and Giles Patterson and Dan Westercott take on the hips and the feet. And Dan also has got a limb recon practice. And it's quite a cohesive and nice unit. We all get on quite well with each other. It's a very pleasant place to work. I mean, I remember Jim Wright, when I was in the Sick Kids, when I was sort of thinking of units to work in, his best bit of advice he gave me, he says, don't choose the unit, don't choose the place, choose the people. And if you pick a unit where you like the people, then you're in for a sort of fairly happy work life.
Well, that's great. I think, you know, Anish was nodding there as well, and I'm sort of nodding as well. So I think the same. Moving on. Now, everyone really knows your instrumental work in getting the UK, you know, CPIP registry up and running. And, you know, thanks again for that. It's really amazing work. But I wanted to discuss something else. So I love this bit of the podcast. It's only the second time I've done it, but where I get to read people's bios, and kind of I'm inherently nosy and I like to know about people. They don't really want to know about me, but that's fine. But yeah, you were sort of talking about, you know, being a fan of IT solutions to healthcare problems and about coding and things. So that really piqued my interest. So just maybe if you tell me a bit about that and kind of maybe some examples of how you've used this.
So this is something I've been interested in ages, and I've been a lifelong geek stroke nerd, even before it was cool to be a geek stroke nerd. In fact, I've never been cool in my entire life, and my daughter now tells me it's quite cool to be a nerd. So anyway, I'll go with it. So I've dabbled with coding at a very amateur level for ages. Coding's not difficult. There's a big mystique around it. Everyone thinks, oh, coding's really hard and it's really common. It's not. It's it, any one of us can do it. If you can
It is
you're absolutely liar. True. Anyone can do it. And if you can be a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, Anish, you can definitely learn to code. And the level I do it at is incredibly basic. I mean, I always feel slightly embarrassed whenever I show my code to anyone who's vaguely professional. I get a little bit self-conscious about the whole thing. But anyway, so one of the beauties about writing programs and writing databases and so forth when you're a surgeon or a doctor is that you know exactly the problem that you want to solve, exactly. And you can tailor your whatever you're writing particularly to that problem. And so, for example, one of the things I've worked on, I wrote an application using the FileMaker platform to kind of change how we record all of our trauma and orthopedic admissions or referrals for the whole department, not just pediatrics. And I digitized the entire AO classification, for example. So everyone who comes into the unit, the juniors can tap on the pictures and it spits out an AO classification. They can link in comorbidities, different consultants, different specialties. Plastics have just joined us as well.
Me and Alfred are talking about how we did similar things too during COVID lockdown.
I just grew my hair and put on
I wish I had some hair to grow, but I've got a tiny bit at the back here for a bit. Unfortunately, that's not one of my strong points. But anyway, so I generally love doing it. It's really good fun. And it's we've now got over 9,000 patients on the database, and all of these patients have got an AO classification for their fractures. So if you want to audit 3-1-B-2 fractures, you can just query the database and boom, all the patients are there. And if you give surgeons or doctors some benefit, then they will use it. So the big benefit to people is they've got lists of their patients instantly accessible, and we've got a couple of cool things. So for example, we've done a bunch of research trial alerts, for example. So if you're a kid who's got a distal radius fracture that meets the criteria for the CRAFT trial, it will pop up an alert as the juniors are entering it saying this patient might be suitable for the CRAFT trial. Please speak to the PI and the nursing associate with the email addresses and so forth. We've got about 7 or 8 different research trial checkers that are within the system. So as the juniors are entering the patients, it flashes up that the patient might be suitable for a particular trial.
That's brilliant. Can you get prompts on that as well?
Yeah. So I've digitized the whole of GOAL, which is the gait outcomes assessment list, Uni Narayanan's one. I'm working on CP Child. Obviously, I'm concentrating on the ones that are relevant to me. But the hand surgeons have got their mini dash score is digitized. That's quite an easy one.
Well, that's really impressive. I mean, you've clearly saved your trust several hundred thousand pounds doing that.
I don't know. I'm not entirely sure about that, but it's...
because you charged him.
So, Steve, we've clearly touched upon a real passion here. And you commented on the inner geek. So I sort of wonder whether that relates to the paper you've chosen to discuss, really, because there is some heavy, heavy stats in there.
There really is. And actually, I don't have to confess, stats is not one of my geeky hobbies, unfortunately. I rely heavily on the statisticians. I'd also have this generally, Gunnar Haglund, for example, he's a bit of a professional crush of mine, as it were, and anything he publishes I sort of lap up, and I tend not to question, but I have tried to question this one a little bit. But the stats is beyond me in this paper. I just love some cubic spline, for example, that just rolls off the tongue so nicely. If anyone knows what a cubic spline is, please
explain. I can tell you that's just how they join the dots, basically.
Oh, there we go. Fantastic. Yeah. I just like the words.
Well, I think then maybe we should move on and discuss this paper, actually. Is that all right, Anish?
You're talking about Philippe Wagner and Gunnar Haglund's paper in Acta Orthopaedica 2022, and it's called Hip Development After Surgery to Prevent Hip Dislocation in CP, a longitudinal register study of 252 children. The references will be on the show notes.
So it's a paper using CPUP data, the Swedish precursor to CPIP. You're allowed to count how many times I say CPIP in this whole talk. I'll try and minimize it as much as possible. Anyway, so that's one of the reasons. So it's just to illustrate some of the stuff you can do with registry data. And as I said in my bio, there is a kind of cult of the RCT in orthopedics, and that it reigns supreme. But there are other ways of getting good information, and registries are, in my mind anyway, almost like second best, if you like. But for example, in hip and knee surgery, no one does RCTs. When a new hip comes out now, they look at the registry data. And so I think we've got a real opportunity to try and sort of, you know, improve the prospective data gathering we get. So that's kind of one of the reasons why I chose it. So yeah, so they used CPUP data, and you know, it's just a gold mine of information, CPUP. If you Google the CPUP website, I think they're up to about 100 odd papers now, and I don't think they've even included 2022 papers yet. So they looked at all their kids in their registry, I think between in a decade period between 2000 2010, who had surgery for hip migration, and they kind of grouped them into two groups, not to directly compare them, but just really to look at what happened. So the one group was the kids that had just had soft tissue surgery, primarily adductor psoas lengthenings, and then the other group were the kids who'd had bony surgery, VDRO plus or minus a pelvic osteotomy. Their kind of indications with surgery was a migration percentage of over 40%, although that wasn't a cast iron thing, and there was no particular guidelines for the surgeon as to what is surgery to. It was up to them what they did. And I think there's about a dozen centers in Sweden that do this kind of surgery. So it was up to the surgeon what to do. They had a minimum of 3-year follow-up. Most had a lot longer than that. And they wanted a set of data where they had migration percentage from 5 years before to at least 3, but preferably 5 years after surgery. So they've got a sort of almost like a 10-year measurement of migration percentage, 5 before, 5 after. And they've got, you know, 252 children, something like 1500 x-rays in that group. And around about 158 just had soft tissue surgery, which I found quite interesting in and of itself, in that I don't often do soft tissue surgery alone for hip migration of more than 40%. I'm far, far more often do bony surgery. In fact, the only ones I can remember doing were very young patients where it was felt they needed a small operation because of other medical comorbidities. So interestingly, they you know, 2/3 of those patients just had adductor psoas lengthenings, and fairly young ages. So I think the mean, what was it? I wrote this down. 5 years was the mean range of 1.5 to 12. So they were doing it as young as 1.5-year-olds, which is certainly younger than I've ever operated on a migrating hip. I think the youngest I've done is 2.5. And out of that group, so out of that 158 who had their adductor psoas lengthening, about 1/3 of them, 54, I think, had a second operation during the study period. And then, so obviously 100 of them then didn't have a second operation. They kind of looked at what really happened to those groups of people. And they found out that the patients, you know, were more likely to need a second operation if their migration velocity was high. So rather than just what the migration percentage was, is how rapidly it was deteriorating. It kind of, when you're getting to this sort of 9 to 10% per year of deterioration in your migration percentage, that's when it's really ramping up your chances of there needing to be a second operation. Now, the initial migration percentage was also important, but yeah, the migration velocity was particularly relevant. And also, as you might expect, the kids who needed the second operation were generally a little bit younger and generally a higher GMSCS level. I think most of us would probably agree with that, in the sense that, you know, the younger you are at the time you get your first dislocated hip and the more severely affected you are, you're probably going to be more likely to have another dislocated hip with or without surgery. So then they compared it with the other group, so the somewhat smaller group, just under 100, who had bony surgery. They were slightly older, I think 6.5, nearly 7 years when they had their surgery, and half of them or so had a pelvic osteotomy in addition to VDROs. And then they looked at, again, about the group, about what happened to the migration percentages before and after surgery. And they found that in only about 15 of them needed a second operation. So these numbers are now getting quite small, so stats become difficult. But generally speaking, they were younger at this time of their index operation than those who needed a second operation and had a higher preoperative migration percentage velocity. So again, similar to the soft tissue group, those whose migration percentage deteriorate faster tend to have a higher chance of then continuing to migrate or recurrent migration post-operatively. But there was 79 or 80 who didn't need the second operation, had obviously a very quick reduction of your migration percentage straight after surgery, as you might expect. If you've just done VDROs and a pelvic osteotomy, you would hope that after your surgery, your migration percentage is less. But it does generally then get worse afterwards, but a kind of an exponential decay. So they call it a second polynomial or whatever. So it starts around about 7% per year getting worse, your migration percentage, and then it gradually tails off to 0% per year. And as I said, out of that 94, only 15 of those required a second operation, but they were a little bit older when they had their index operation. The other thing I thought was quite interesting in the, so going back to the soft tissue group, they found that most those patients who didn't need the second operation after soft tissue surgery alone, their migration percentage tended to decrease a little bit every year, 1 or 2% per year, just gradually comes down a little bit after your soft tissue surgery, possibly as the cartilaginous roof starts to ossify and the, presumably you've got your hip in a better position. But if post-operatively your migration percentage starts going up, then it really, really makes it very likely you're going to be in the needing a second operation group. So for if you do initial soft tissue surgery alone, seeing what your migration percentage does for a year or two or three after that surgery seems to be quite strongly predictive of whether or not that child's going to end up needing a second operation, which kind of makes sense, but it's a kind of a useful guide. So I suppose to summarize then, they basically said three things, I think. And I do hope Gunnar Haglund is not listening to this, otherwise I'm sure he'll criticize all of this. But anyway, so generally speaking, I think the take-home messages I took was that if you have a high
velocity... Everyone listens to this.
If you have a high velocity of pre-op migration percentage increase, so then generally speaking, you're going to do worse and be more likely to require a second operation, particularly if you're starting to get to sort of 9, 10% per year. If you've got a higher absolute migration percentage on the date of your initial surgery, or you're young at the time of your first surgery, then again, you're more likely to then require a second operation. And then I said, the other take-home message is that, you know, in CPUP data, they're doing quite a lot of soft tissue surgery alone, which I don't do much of. So again, it might sort of influence my practice. I've always been fairly negative about soft tissue surgery alone based on, you know, other papers that have come out in the past. And so, I just think I've got a couple of patients in mind now who are relatively young, you know, adductor tightness. Maybe they would benefit from, you know, adductor psoas lengthening rather than jumping in and doing VDROs.
So, Steve, you know, my first take on this paper was, all soft tissue surgery must be better than bony surgery, is what I initially thought. But then it's a bit like you said, you know, if you're counselling the family, what we're saying is that 150 children who had soft tissue surgery, it's about a third that are going to need to have further surgery. And what, as you said, they didn't make clear really was how people chose whether they're just doing soft tissue procedures or they're going to be doing bony procedures. And when you do your VDRO, do you normally do a medial soft tissue release?
Yeah, so that's another thing. I was going to chat to Mark Gaston because he knows Gunnar's practice better than I do. But it seemed from the text of the paper that it was VDRO only, rather than VDRO and soft tissue release, but I wasn't quite sure based on the paper whether that was true or not. But yeah, almost invariably, if I'm doing VDROs, the patients are getting some kind of soft tissue release, you know, at a minimum, a percutaneous adductor tenotomy, more often than not, an open, you know, adductor psoas release. It's also interesting what you said about the point of the paper. So I don't think the point of his paper is to try and compare and contrast one with the other. It's literally just looking at what the migration percentage does and then using lots of clever stats in these groups to try and come up with some risk factors for what might make your migration percentage get worse after surgery.
But I think registry is obviously amazing, but I do feel that they didn't really ask any questions from the outset. They were just kind of like, we got data, we had a look at it, and this is kind of what you got. It would have been nice in a way to frame the paper around some sort of questions of things that they were particularly interested in, you know, ideally some hypotheses. But they were just like, well, we analyzed the development of the hip. And, you know.
I think they did it with a view to looking at what happens after surgery. And obviously they've got the two groups of just the soft tissue and the bony surgery. But I don't think the point of the paper was to try and compare one with the other. The paper can't do that based upon the analysis. And it's not looking at survivorship of one operation versus the other using, you know, reoperation as an endpoint. That's not really what it's designed to do. As you said, Alpesh, it's just really looking at the data they got, which is high quality prospectively gathered data on a whole population. So there's more than 95% of their kids in Sweden are in the database. There's no one missing from this. It reduces that kind of risk of losing some patients. But you're right, it's not that kind of paper. It's not really designed to answer the question. It's a little bit more thought provoking than that, I think, just saying that this is what happens. You can interpret that how you wish. I don't think this is going to massively change my practice, other than that I wonder if I might recommend soft tissue surgery a little bit more often, possibly.
A couple of questions that just really for your practice. You've got over a decade of experience in this field. So two things. Firstly, from a sort of phase validity perspective, a lot of these things are linear relationships. Do you find that that's what you see with these hips, that they linearly get worse, or do they exponentially get, or do you think that what happens is that you get some which are fine in this group, some which are exponentially, and it kind of boils down to a linear relationship?
It seems to be very variable, actually. So Mark Gaston's paper, the point of no return paper, is quite, look at this. If you look at the all of the hips in his series and what happened to them over a period of time, there's a lot of variability, with some getting worse, some getting better, some linearly getting worse, some linearly getting better, some sort of seem to be exponentially. It seems to be incredibly variable from individual to individual. Now, this paper seemed to imply that the best fit, if you like, was a linear within this sort of subset of patients that they looked at. It seemed to be fairly linear in most cases, except for, I think, the only one was the deterioration after post VDRO, where they have a rapid improvement, as you'd expect, and then a sort of exponential decay, if you like, of worsening afterwards. But the other relationships seem to best fit a linear one. But then again, as you said, if you look at the graphs at the bottom, they're kind of all over the place. The stats, the details of the stats are beyond my expertise, but it seemed to be that linear fitted the data best.
And then, sorry, this is what the other thing was in your practice. So here they were doing soft tissue lengthening VDRAs, but not that many pelvic osteotomies, seemingly. I mean, in Oxford, we tend to always pelvic osteotomy pretty much.
Yeah, there aren't many. I just do VDROs. It's really, they use the sort of anastabular index of more than 30 degrees, I think, as their kind of suggested cutoff. However, for me not to do a pelvic osteotomy, the anastabulum has to look pretty much normal, completely normal. If it looks anything but normal, then I'll tend to add in a pelvic osteotomy. So, but what would be, I mean, one of the other interesting things about this paper, I think they mentioned it in the start, this is based on the whole population of just over 1 million. In the UK, we've got a whole population of well over 60 million. So we could potentially, if we had data this good, have 60 times, instead of talking about 250 hips, we could be talking about, I don't know, whatever 60 times 250 is, so 15,000 hips or whatever. So, and then you can start chopping the data up a little bit more and having some, either confirming what Gunnar's saying or maybe coming up with new information and so forth. So it's just almost a hint of what could be achieved in the UK if we had this kind of 95% of our population, CP population, on a registry.
I'm going to follow on from the other paper. That's the JPO, January 2022. It's by Aria et al., but as you mentioned, it's got some other big names on there, Eric Gordon, Perry Schoenecker, and Puya Hosanzadeh. And that was looking at failure of hip reconstruction in children with CP. And their question, because they had a question they wanted to answer, is what are the risk factors? So in this paper, it was over an 8-year period. They looked at children between the ages of 1 and 18 years with at least 2 years of radiographic follow-up. And they were looking for failure, which they defined as either a migration percentage of over 50%, or a need for subsequent ipsilateral hip reconstruction. They detail their technical procedure. So everyone got a medial soft tissue release, which I think is what we'd say is standard. The VDRO, they're aiming for a neck shaft angle for between 115 and 125 with an antiversion corrected to 0 to 10 degrees. And then they said plus minus acetabular osteotomy and an open reduction for some. They did 291 hips in 179 patients. So actually the numbers are pretty good over that period. The mean age at surgery was about 8 years and had a mean follow-up of just under 4 years. Half of the group got only femoral osteotomies, 41% got femur and pelvis, and 8% only got the pelvis. And what they found, and I think this is useful data personally, is that there was a 13% failure rate. And the risk factors, which I think a lot of the literature is showing in this paper and the one that we mentioned before, age at initial surgery, they said if you're under six, you had a 26% chance of recurrence versus 6%. If your preoperative migration percentage index was over 70%, you had an almost 30% chance of recurrence versus 7%. And if your neck shaft angle was over 150, you had an odds ratio of 10 for failure. And then the other thing that they highlighted that I thought was interesting was they talk about doing the acetabular osteotomy when your acetabular index is over 25 degrees. And they said by doing that, you reduce the chances of failure fourfold. So I really liked that paper because it was quite succinct. It didn't have the funky graphs. We didn't see the ski slopes and things. And yes, it wasn't a population-based study, but for a simple mind like me, it kind of answered some of the questions that I think I can use when I'm talking to families to try and give them some solid evidence or figures. And as you said, one of the things is we don't know what the recurrence rates are and the failure rates. So this is quite nice when you are looking at your patients 2 to 3 years down the line thinking, okay, some of these are going to fail. And I guess the question is, do you think if we screen and we screen well, so we don't get to these migration percentages of 70%, does that mean we're going to have less recurrence, less risk factor for failure?
I think there's two things there. I suppose if you are screening your entire population, I suppose one possibility is you might operate earlier because you're picking up migration sooner. And as we know, if you operate earlier, the failure rate is higher. However, potentially earlier surgery may have better outcomes. So we all know that, you know, a horribly high dislocated hip is a very difficult thing to deal with. We, you know, might try and reconstruct it. We might try and excise it. We might even try and replace it. But they are really challenging scenarios. So to my mind, doing an operation early, even if the recurrence rate is higher, as long as I can keep that hip in for that patient's lifetime, then that's a positive outcome, even if that requires two operations, which are done well, rather than one operation later with a worse outcome. So, I it won't come as any surprise to anyone listening. I'm very pro-surveillance, and I almost think that a dislocated hip is something that shouldn't happen in cerebral palsy.
Brilliant, thank you. So we're going to move on to something just as important. Okay, so this is our second podcast. So it's the sequel. And as you know, we want to talk about sequels. We put stuff out on Twitter and we've got some good responses. But Steve, what would be your favorite or worst sequel, be it film, TV or music?
So it's got to be film. I was struggling to think of any music sequels. Like the only one I could think of off the top of my head was Use Your Illusion 2, which is phenomenal. But anyway, so films is probably my favorite. And I've got two real sequels. And again, these aren't going to shock anyone. It's Aliens and Terminator 2, both of which are just unbelievably good films and phenomenal
sequels.
Can you
do your impression? Can you do your impression of Arnie, please?
I thought you were going to ask me to do an impression of an alien.
Terminator. I want the line. I need the line.
I'll be back.
Oh, no, that's not the one.
Oh, well, which one were you expecting?
I was thinking, hasta la vista.
Oh, that maybe. One, okay, fair enough.
Was that the Gujarati Terminator that you
But yeah, I love both of those.
And then what about you, Alpesh? Favourite sequel or worst?
Well, you maybe saw that I sort of retweeted Emily Baird's Terminator 2, but 100%. But Die Hard, admitted, was an awesome movie. Die Hard 2 is also a really good movie. And it also has a really catchy line in there, which I'll get Steve to maybe later on.
I was just thinking that maybe
we'll need the bleep button for that. Yeah. But I think maybe
isn't it, in the PG rating of it is Yippee-ki-yay Kimusabi, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and it's dubbed over really badly, so you can literally say his lips say what we all know he's saying, but it says Kimusabi over the top.
In terms of other suggestions, so I've got to mention worst sequel, Batman and Robin. Helen Chase put that on Twitter, and I have to agree, nipples on a bat suit, ridiculous.
Is that the one with George Clooney?
It is.
Yeah, that is truly terrible.
Yeah. And then we have got Mamma Mia 2, which I haven't seen, but it's got to be better than the first one, because everything would be. That was Sue Deakin. But Jonathan Wright came up with Paddington 2, and I have to say that is a classic sequel. Anyone else seen it?
I've seen the first one. I've not seen the second one.
It is good. The other thing I was thinking about sequels is that there's not insignificant number of sequels where the lead actor is different to the first. So, and I was thinking this was potentially an opportunity. It's like that has set the precedent. So I thought maybe with the second podcast, you get rid of me, get someone better chatted.
No, we're going to use a different face. It's going to be Millie Vanilli. And then, yeah, so Laura Derry, she mentioned Empire Strikes Back, and I was very impressed with that. And then Lester, I think it was Alwyn Abraham, mentioned Godfather 2, which is, again, an absolute classic, isn't it? You've got Pacino, De Niro, but they never meet each other. How about you, Pranay? Anything you'd add?
I mean, if you're going to get old school classic, and it may not be as good as the first, but I feel just as good, Home Alone 2.
Yeah.
I mean, I know we're past Christmas, but blimey. Move it to a new place, and how does it go wrong twice? But what a follow-up from the first one.
What about Police Academy 4, Citizens on Patrol? No one mentioning that. I can't believe it.
Right.
I think when we get to episode 7, we'll talk about those.
Okay, I think it's time we move on now
research.
So to my bite sizes. And actually, we're going to just stick with CP for the time being, because another really good paper, which really sort of applies to lots of our practices, came out of Cincinnati in Ohio. So it was Laron et al. From JPO, February 2022. So this paper's fascia iliaca pain block results in lower overall opioid usage and shorter hospital stays than epidural anesthesia after hip reconstruction in children with cerebral palsy. So I thought this was a really interesting paper. And actually, after I read it, I sent it to my anaesthetist, and I was like, what do you think? They haven't replied yet. So it was a retrospective non-randomized cohort study where they basically had 60 patients having CP hip reconstruction, same surgeon, and they compared those having FI nerve block alone versus those having epidural. And they used this FLAC score, which is basically a score used for young or non-communicative patients, where you look at face, legs, activity, cry, and consolability. It's a scale. 37 patients having an FI block and 22 having an epidural with ropivacaine. So they could, both groups of patients could have opioids afterwards. And they looked at this FLAC score, post-operative day 1, 2, and 3. They looked at other things, including how much the opioid requirements really and the length of stay, as well as time before, you know, knife to skin and how long the patient was in the OR. I thought the findings were really interesting, actually. So in the firstly, as you'd expect, if you're just doing FI blocks, the patient gets on the table quicker and spends less time in the OR. And that's really important in such a vulnerable patient group, certainly. Secondly, the FLAC scores, so essentially the pain scores, were better post-operative day one in the FI nerve block group compared to the epidural. And also that group used less opioids and had shorter hospital stay. So in Oxford, our patients have epidural routinely for 3 days, and then the pain team steps them down. And often they're in the hospital for really quite a long time, 5 to 7 days sometimes. And this paper really made me think, and I thought maybe we're just doing it all wrong at the moment. So I'll be interested to hear what my anaesthetists say. I'm also interested to hear what you guys think about the paper.
I thought it was incredible. I did mention it to our anaesthetist, and I've sent him a copy highlighting that it said 11 minutes for a nerve block and 14 minutes for a lumbar epidural. I'd like to see their thoughts about that. Our anaesthetists are great people, but no, it's the same. So I've just about managed to convince them that if we're doing femoral osteotomies, bilateral femoral osteotomies, you don't need an epidural. So we'll do that under blocks. Pelvic work, we would still use an epidural, but based on this paper, I'm definitely going to ask them to reconsider that. And I think this is going to have implications for hospitals across the country. There are units where the anaesthetist and more importantly, the nursing staff on the ward aren't used to looking after epidurals. You need a certain level of HDU. So if you can do this effectively with a nerve block, that's going to open up surgery to more units, which could, it's got to be a good thing. Well, doesn't have to be a good thing, actually. It could be a good thing. How about you, Steve? Do you guys use lumbar epidurals a lot?
Yeah, so we use a bit like you for femurs and pelvis, we use epidurals. It's interesting, actually, this paper. So I'm quite a big fan of epidurals when they work. So if you've got the epidural in and it's clearly working, one of the issues about this paper almost doesn't sort of meet the sniff test, really. How does post-op day two pain relief be as good with a single shot block as a functioning epidural? So did they include all epidurals in this group, even if they're clearly not functioning? So, you know, our pain team do check epidural function and block level and so forth. If it's not working, we'll abandon it and try something else. But, you know, in those kids where the epidural generally works, it can be a phenomenal pain relief for a long period of time. And a bit like you, Alpesh, we usually leave the epidural in for 3 days. And I was very surprised that they're getting some patients home on day three or day four.
Yeah. I mean, I think the other thing is that they were just putting ropivacaine in there.
And yes, exactly.
Our anaesthetists, like yeah. other stuff, they put clonidine in there and yeah. stuff.
And opiates.
Yeah.
And so it's a tricky one. So I do like the idea of a shorter block, you know, that's quicker, and you can do it without the, because one of the other problems that we have is that if we put an epidural in, the patient has to be on our HDU. We can't manage epidurals on the open ward. And we've had a few occasions where our HDU has been full. And so we've had to effectively cancel an all-day CP case because we've had no HDU bed for them to go into post-operatively. Unfortunately, we don't have the luxury of an ITU. But, you know, if there's an option there that we can do a block and manage the patient on a ward rather than in HDU, that would certainly be improved. But I've read the paper as well, and like, it seems to be fairly convincing, and it'd be interesting to see what our anaesthetists think of it and whether or not it's worth the sort of thing that makes you think, oh, that's right for a trial, really, isn't it? It's to compare one with the other. And also, it could be, again, you've got to sort of be cognizant of the fact there are different protocols and with what goes in the epidural and so forth. So yeah, it's an interesting paper and it's certainly something that I think needs some further work.
Great. So that was a good paper, I thought. And moving on to another paper, which sort of affects my practice, was a paper from Benan Della Ali he's in Milton Keynes. He's working in our network at the moment. He's a good guy. He published in BJJ. I think it was January, was it, or February? So this was looking at osteofibrous dysplasia of the tibia and the importance of deformity and surveillance. And this was basically a collected group of patients from RNOH, GOSH, and Melbourne Children's looking at osteofibrous dysplasia. And they had 101 bones in 99 patients with a mean follow-up of 5.65 years. Just basically looking at what happened, essentially. And I think the interesting points for me were that when there's less deformity, there's a better chance for conservative management to be successful. A really key one here is the finding none of the osteofibrous dysplasia lesions transformed into adamantinoma. And that's basically been the concern ongoing. And then you've also got this LFD-like adamantinoma, which gets everyone worried. So everyone's very concerned about a pre-malignant condition. They stated when you have wide excision, it's associated with really high complication rate. And the upshot was basically they advocated a conservative approach to the management of osteofibrous dysplasia with regular surveillance, which I thought was particularly interesting because also in 2006, some of the members were some similar patients. They had 16 patients only at that stage, published paper. And I think their tagline was, we recommend extra periosteal excision in all cases of osteofibrous dysplasia with segmental excision and reconstruction, more extensive lesions. And that paper is often cited in our MDT when we have osteofibrous dysplasia. And I've got a couple of patients at the moment, one who I have resected and the other I'm watching and waiting because it will be such an extensive resection and bone transport we required. And so it's nice to see this paper now. They've had more data, they've had time to look at things maybe more comprehensively and have come to a slightly different conclusion, which I think aligns with, so Steve, your colleague Dan Westercott, he published on this as well, good series from Sick Kids. And so it's good to see the bigger series are now recommending a more conservative approach. And that's great, I think.
I think so. We did a study, actually. We surveyed EPOS members a few years ago about OFD, and we actually sent them pictures. So it was an electronic survey. None of them were recommending a wide local excision. And this would have been about maybe 8 years ago. So I think it's amazing how this paper, the 2006 one about a radical approach, changed what so many people were doing. When I went to Sydney, they were talking about that paper and how you've got to be very careful with OFD. But that's science for you, isn't it? It's great to see that they looked at those patients again and actually concluded that, no, we don't need to do massive excisions for them and shark bites and things.
Okay, so then moving on to something else that piqued my interest was for International Orthopedics in February. So this was Abdel Azim et al. So it was an Egyptian and French collaboration. Was looking at orthopedic training during COVID-19 pandemic, should action be taken? So they basically, in this paper, they undertook a survey of the world, of PSYCOT members, and they had 230 respondents from 76 countries and six continents, basically looking at the impact of COVID on training. Some of the upshots of it, 78% believe COVID had a significant impact on training. I was surprised it was that low. 59% reported no action from their training, national training body. They sort of reported about some extensions, and only 19% of respondents thought that trainees could catch up. It was a slightly skewed, specimens, selection of responses. So it was like 19 from the UK, which is relatively small population wise. But I think this particularly salient at the moment because a lot of the trainees I'm working with are all basically being extended now and are really struggling to get any experience. So ST4s at the moment, they're kind of all their training's been in COVID. It's been very difficult. And I don't know as a TPD, Anish, what you're finding in Norfolk and Norwich.
So in the east of England, it has been variable. And actually the guys that were ST7 and ST8, they had a big buffer of cases. They'd already met their indicative procedures and the appropriate PBA. So actually those guys got through pretty much without any difficulty. Some of the ST7s have had a lot of work to do, but actually this is what I've admired. When you look at some of these trainees, they're putting in the hours, they're going to extra lists. I think nationally there's been a great move by the BOA, by the Royal College of Surgeons, to prioritize training, JCST, so using private hospitals where possible. And again, you've got to have your hats off to the consultants who are taking the trainees down to the private sector, because it does have an impact on them, doesn't it? These are patients that they're going to have to look after. So actually, I think there's been a concerted effort that's been coordinated at multiple levels to try and get our trainees through. So I'm actually more optimistic than I was at the onset of all of this. But I think the effects are going to be there for years to come. So you mentioned the specialty trainees, even the core trainees. Some of those core trainees didn't actually do orthopedics during their orthopedic block. And suddenly you're a specialty trainee expected to do some operations. So I think there is going to be an impact that we're going to feel for quite some time.
Well, thanks for that update. I think Oxford's always been a bit on the brink of people not getting all their cases indicative numbers, and I think this is potentially will depend on region, potentially how big an impact it's going to have. So,
yeah, I think it's also having a bit of an impact on. You mentioned the core trainees, so I think this year we've only got one new ST3 slot available. I think in Coventry. I'm not a TPD, so I may be wrong, but it's a very small number, and I think it's partly because of people having training extended, so not then dropping off the top. So obviously that has no knock-on effect to the core trainees who want ST3 jobs.
Okay, great. So my final paper. So this was from the Christmas BMJ. Everyone knows about the slightly quirky articles that they have in the Christmas BMJ, but usually actually pretty good science. It's called Bar Humbug, Association Between Sending Christmas Cards to Trial Participants and Trial Retention, randomized study with a trial conducted simultaneously across 8 host trials. And so this was Coleman et al., and it was a collaboration between York and Aberdeen. Firstly, there's a lovely sort of infographic, like a visual abstract, which has a robin on it, which I thought was very nice. But basically, they highlight the difficulty in retaining participants in trials. And that people running trials want to do anything possible to keep these people in. And so something that they do is send Christmas cards as a, you know, we're nice guys and we remember you, thanks for all your hard work. But there's no evidence to show that that works. And so it's like, well, why spend time, money, CO2 to send cards if it's not going to work? So they ran these, they call it study within a trial, across multiple trials, essentially randomizing people to whether they're going to get a Christmas card or not. And they found basically that it didn't affect the retention of the participants. I think about 85% of participants stayed retained at the sort of same time point. So that was quite interesting. So basically Christmas cards don't really do anything. But I think what they showed was that this methodology can do something, and you can undertake these studies within a trial to get even more information. I think White's was a bit like that. There were lots of studies within the main trial, and that's been one of its powers. The only thing I would say is that the Christmas card they sent out was pretty ropey. But anyway.
That could be the next study where they compare different Christmas card patterns. Right. So I'm going to move on to my bite-sized paper. So the first one I'm going to talk about is JPO February 2022, and it's called Novel Uses of Traditional Algorithms for Septic Arthritis. This got my attention because I thought, oh, what's the novel use? And actually all they did was use it to look at joints other than the hip. So not that novel. But their point is a valid one. Everyone has taken Cocker and Caird's criteria, as people call them, and used them on any joint. And all they were doing was to see is it valid? And what they conclude is that it's pretty much as valid as Cocker's criteria and the Caird algorithm is for the hip joint. And anyone who's heard me speak knows that I don't think they're very good. I don't know what you guys think, but what they did was they looked at 213 patients, hip, knee, ankle, shoulder, elbow, and wrist. 60 of those 200 had an infection. And then they created loads of these ROC curves, the receiver operating characteristic curves. And I did a little bit of reading about this, and you look at the area under the curve. And if you've got something like 0.7 to 0.8, that's acceptable. But let's say you had 0.8, that means you will miss 20% of infections. And so what they found was that the area under the curve for Cocker for all joints is 0.75. So that means you're going to miss 25%. And for Caird, it's 0.8. So you're going to miss 20%. And then they looked at hip transient synovitis and comparing it to septic arthritis. And what was really interesting was, just like every other study, they can't replicate the results of the original centers. But what they found is Cocker is best if you only use two of the four markers. Then apparently the sensitivity is 60% and the area under the curve is 0.72. Whereas if you have three, it goes down to 0.6. This makes no sense to me at all. So at this point, I've lost interest in the paper. You just think, actually, it tells me that algorithms don't work. And yeah, what they said is it shows that the algorithms can be used in other joints, but I'd say not particularly reliably. And please use history examination, not just algorithms. What do you guys think? Is this where you tell me that you guys base all your practice on those two algorithms and the septic hip app?
So it's interesting. Every time, you know, I help deliver the limping child teaching to our medical students, and they all know about Cocker's criteria. That there's MCQs on it, there's exam questions on it. It's in the kind of medical student teaching, and I still teach it, even though I know it's not the best, particularly for joints that aren't the hip and for bugs that aren't Staph aureus. And so it's a tricky one. But I do still use it. But everyone, you know, we've recently got a point of care ultrasound type thing, you know, a little ultrasound that you can plug into an iPad, and you know, all four of us, when we see a kid with a query septic arthritis, we take our little iPad with our ultrasound probe and stick it on the hip and see if there's fluid in it. And so it's kind of the Cocker's criteria or Caird is just an adjunct to that rather than a definitive decision making tool. But I still do it.
I think it's a good framework to base your history and examination on, but I don't think we should be making firm decisions on it. The next paper is something a little bit more basic, but it's about Osgood-Schlatter's disease. And this was published in International Orthopedics 2022, and it's from Germany. And basically they've published the results of a large clinical series. And I have to be honest, it's the kind of thing that you wouldn't normally try and look up. You never really say, oh, let me find out about Osgood-Schlatter's. So the most interesting thing I heard about was, who was Osgood Schlatter, guys? Do you guys know? No, they're shaking their heads. I was tricking you. So it's a little bit like Leg Calve Perthes. So Osgood was American and Schlatter was Swiss. And both of them in 1908 independently described this condition. So that was my biggest learning point from this. So you can now amaze everyone around you. But basically, they looked at 126 consecutive patients from one pediatric orthopedic department over 5 years. And they looked at various things. They examined them, they ultrasounded them. Apparently, they even did a lateral x-ray for each of them. And what they did was find that rectus femoris and the iliopsoas muscles were shortened in these patients. And the useful figures in this really were that they had a median follow-up of 3.6 years. Most patients were symptom-free after 19 months. And for me, that was the kind of headline. Okay, so if I see someone with Osgood Schlatter's, I've always said it'll come and go, and when you finish growing, it will stop growing. But it's about 2 years. 50% are symptom-free after 16 months and 3/4 after 2 years. Interestingly, 80% of patients still reported a bit of pain, mild pain and tenderness, either when they kneeled or when someone pressed on their tibial tuberosity, even when it was all over. So I thought that was interesting. It's not groundbreaking, but it's the kind of thing that actually most of us could probably use in our practice. And then there was another interesting paper in good old International Orthopedics. And this is from Cairo. And this is actually a prospective randomized controlled trial run over 5 years. And they were talking about whether capsulorraphy is a necessary step during open reduction of DDH. And they took 82 hips and 67 kids. The big thing is, though, this was not just an open reduction. The mean age at surgery was 33 months. And everyone in their hospital that was over age 12 months got an open reduction with a Dagar and maybe a femoral osteotomy. So it's not just an anterior open. One group got a capsulorraphy and the other group didn't. And looking at the figures, both groups were pretty identical. They used a clinical evaluation based on stability of the hip, limping, Trendelenburg sign and range of movement. And they used the Severin grading system for the x-ray outcome. And they found no difference between the two groups in terms of outcomes, including ABN or redislocation rate. Interestingly, it wasn't statistically significant, but the complication rate was higher in the capsulorraphy group, 17%, versus the group where they didn't repair the capsule, which was 12%. And what they have suggested, which apparently other papers have suggested, they've got a few references, is that when you tighten up that capsule, you're actually causing fibrosis, which may push the hip and sublux it slightly posteriorly. And I have to say, it's the kind of thing, I don't know how you guys feel about your capsulorraphies, but I always feel like it's a really important step. But actually, when you think about it, if you've done the bony bits, I think it's, and that's why I stress this was not just an anterior open. I think if you do an anterior open reduction, we've always said that's the benefit of going anteriorly, is you can repair the capsule properly as opposed to medial open reduction. But I think if you are doing all this bony work, then maybe the capsule and getting that tight closure isn't so important. What do you guys think?
I think that's a really interesting paper, actually, because also the other thing is that when you look at ways to do a capsulorraphy, there's so many different ways. And like sometimes the geometry just doesn't really figure. And you just think, how is that working in a sort of three-dimensional hip? And so, yeah, it's almost nice to hear these findings, because I'm sometimes a bit suspicious about how critical it is, especially when you're doing the pelvic and the femoral osteotomy.
Yeah. How about you, Steve?
So I don't really do DDH surgery anymore, but like you, Anish, I was taught that that first capsulorraphy suture is the most important suture, and that's what stops the hip redislocating. And certainly when I did do it, I remember thinking, good grief, if the whole redislocation is based on that one suture I put in, I'm a bit concerned. But anyway, I sent this paper to Dan Westercott just to see his opinion. And he basically said what you said, Anish, get the bones right, get the hip in joint, and everything else will follow. And it's an interesting, you don't often get RCTs in peds ortho, so I think it should be applauded when you get one. And it seems to, show some interesting results.
Yeah. And then I'm just going to talk about two more papers. One was from Oslo, Terry Turgeson's unit, published in the BJJ December issue. And basically they looked at the modified Stuhlberg classification and said that it's a very good predictor of radiologic outcome in the longer term, 20 years after diagnosis. So the modified Stuhlberg is basically taking the Stuhlberg classifications and the five grades and making them three. So you get Stuhlberg 1 and 2 become just the round hips. 3 is ovoid, and 4 and 5 are lumped together as the flat hips. And what they essentially found, I won't go into all the details, have a look in BJJ, but they found that if you you can use your 5-year x-ray, so the x-ray taken 5 years after diagnosis, and look at that modified Stolberg classification, and it actually will help you predict what the outcome is going to be for that hip. So if you had a flat hip at that 5-year x-ray, you had 54% chance of having a bad outcome. So either, so looking at their series, they found that 3 had osteoarthritis and 11 had had a total hip replacement by the age of 30. Whereas actually, when you look at the round hips, very few of them had. I think it was 1 out of 37 round hips developed osteoarthritis. Now, the numbers weren't massive. This was based on a prospective registry that they ran in Norway between 96 and 2000. They had 425 patients and they used 88 of those patients and they had 100 hips. But for me, what I thought was very useful is we often say to patients when you see them with Perthes disease, oh, you might run into problems of arthritis. This will give us a little bit more in way of counseling them. And I thought it's a simple paper, but something that I can use in my practice. And then the final paper I'm going to talk about, which I think is going to be groundbreaking, is for anyone here who has to look after patients with ingrown toenails. And you may have wondered whether your hind foot alignment is related to your risk of ingrown toenails. And now the answer is there. If you look at military recruits, what they found was that more of those who had ingrown toenails actually had hind foot valgus. And so they did a case control study where they looked at this. They took 103 patients with ingrown toenails. A control group of 63 patients was included. So I can't actually keep a straight face. I'm reading this and I'm thinking, I think the big question in this is why? Why did they do this? I think rather than treating the ingrown toenail, we either have to give them insoles or maybe do some sort of calcaneal lengthening osteotomy, was my conclusion. It's one of those papers where you think it's an interesting question, but I'm just surprised someone, maybe they had access to military recruits and they thought we've looked at everything else. What else can we now look at?
So yeah. Anish, sorry, you haven't mentioned the journal. I need to look this up.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sorry, mate. I wanted to keep it to myself.
All right.
This is, do you know,
I haven't Lancet, is it?
No. Right, yes. But we'll get in trouble for having said that. The reference tells me it's a Science Direct journal. I'm going to click here. It will tell me. Drum roll. Foot and ankle surgery. I mean, this is even a pretty big journal. Foot and ankle surgery, January 2022. So there you go. Proper science for you. And that's my little roundup of what I thought was interesting in the literature.
Thank you.
So, guys, thank you very much, Steve. It's been a pleasure having you on.
It's been great fun. That time's flown by.
We want to thank everyone at BizCos. And I think we've got to make a special mention of BizCos and what Marcus Catchburian, Joe Dartnell, Ran Timmy and Sam achieved last week. It was brilliant, wasn't it? I mean, sorry, Alpesh, Steve, we missed you. We were pining.
Yeah, thanks, mate. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. But we learned lots and especially how to salsa dance. That was awesome. I've just about recovered from it all.
So Anish, I saw some photos from BizCos of other people, but I saw some, they had you in the background. It looked like you were wearing a particularly strong shirt.
You know, that shirt got many comments and I'd like to say compliments, but I think I'm just going to have to say comments. Everyone kept going, oh, you're wearing a Hawaiian shirt. And I was walking around going, no, it's Japanese print. But yeah, thank you very much for pointing that out, Alpesh. Cheers. Right. On that note, I think we'll bring matters to an end and say thank you for listening. Please do subscribe, rate and review and share information about our podcast on social media. And we'll be back with you in June, having reviewed another 3 months of literature.